Hey guys, how's it going? This is Nanop, and I have with me your favorite co-host, Amalaya.
Hey everyone, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whenever and wherever you're listening. We're so excited to have you here for the second podcast of the Afropolitan Central.
Whoop, 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 whoop. We are super, super excited, as we always are. Thank you so much for tuning in to listen to us. So, unless you're living under a rock, you probably know the Black Panther has been out for like, what, a month now, has been breaking box office records everywhere, crossed over $1 billion dollars in sales right now. So it's just been such an amazing cultural phenomenon almost. I've already seen it four times, Olayo.
Wait, how many times have you seen it?
I've seen it four times already.
Wow, okay. I don't even blame you. If I could, I would. I've seen it twice. So I'm just really excited the way Black Panther has been received. And all the conversations that have been happening around it. So we're just really excited to kind of have a slightly different conversation about Black Panther today. So we're going to kind of walk you through, of course, our initial thoughts about Black Panther, why we love it so much, but then also just like take it back a little bit and talk about what it means for development in Africa. All right, so we're just going to walk you through a little bit of the research that we found around, you know, different conversations that have been happening around African development and what that means in today's world and kind of like, of course, the effect that colonialism has had on it. But before we get into all that, let's talk about Black Panther.
Hey. So I think I speak for all of us when I say that we've all been like super excited and just waiting for this movie, because I remember, in, was it 2015 or something? Like, I heard that the go-ahead had been given and Ryan Coogler was going to direct it. And I was, and bear in mind, like, I'm not a comic fan. So I had no idea about the, you know, the Black Panther comic and the story behind it or what, like, I was completely new to it. However, you know, just the thought about, like a Black superhero movie, I was like, what? I am excited. But of course in 2015, 2018 felt like a lifetime away. You were like, when the heck is it ever going to be this movie? And then of course, Captain America, Civil War came out, and we saw T'Challa and Dora Milaje and Kinta Chaka for the first time, and then it just...
So I actually didn't even see that movie, what? So I was like, all of this was super new to me. Super like, insane. I have not seen that many of the Avengers movies. I think, yeah, I've seen a few,
yeah,
but I did not see the one where Black Panther and Dora Milaje stood up,
yeah,
you know, as part of it. I feel like maybe I heard people talking about it, but I was like, whatever. And so it wasn't really until I saw the trailer of the movie that I was like, oh my gosh, this is coming out. And then I remember when I first saw the trailer, it was back in like maybe the summer of 2017, and okay, I was like, February 2018 is too far away. This movie needs to come out tomorrow.
Yeah.
So definitely the hype has been there from day one.
Exactly.
And the best part is that it did live up to the hype, because there are a lot of movies that, you know, yeah, everyone is like super hyped, yeah, for, and then you get there and like, you're like, okay, but like, I felt, yeah, like Black Panther not only lived up to the hype but also surpassed it in just like the level of depth that they put into the world and the characters.
I completely agree. Like, I had a running joke, and I think I saw a couple of memes too to the same effect, where they're like, even if we go on Black Panther, it's trash. Like, we are never uttering those words from our lips. Like, we will just tell everyone it was the best movie ever. But it is amazing. Yeah, it is amazing that I didn't even have to lie. Like, I didn't have to even get to that point. Like, I completely went in super hyped, but also like, you know what, I'm not gonna set my expectations to the roof and let this poor movie like not be able to reach it. But I was completely blown away. Like, I think, you know, with Wakanda and, you know, how it was imagined, how it was presented with, you know, be it the people and the fact that, you know, authentic languages were spoken. I know that there were some where there were mixtures of some.
They really pulled on, like, yes, real African cultures. I mean, like, yes, that was a lot of things that they imagined, but it's not that they just pulled everything out of thin air. Like, everything from the accessories of the Dora Milaje and, the, you know, the architecture that you're going to talk about in a little bit.
Yeah.
They pulled that from actual African cultures,
exactly,
across the Saharan,
exactly,
space.
Exactly. I think, you know, we can't talk about Black Panther without talking about Ruth Carter, who was, like, the costume designer. I know Ryan Coogler did a tour of some of the Southern African countries because he really wanted to get a better understanding of what exactly that he was going to be presenting in the movie. And I think that for me, as an African, watching, you know, Black Panther and watching the presentation of Wakanda and its people and, you know, this African country that is so technologically developed, and not even only technologically too, like from a social standpoint, like you have a kingdom where men and women are just doing their own thing, and like in terms of gender balance, like it's been it's completely, you know, it's completely awesome, so to speak, in the sense that, you know, the women are fierce and they're doing their own thing and nobody's stopping and saying, oh, but you're a woman and you should be, like, none of that. Like, everybody is just, you know, living their best life, so to speak. I think that was beautiful to see. And I think that for me, particularly as an African, like, I know I've seen lots of different think pieces about, like, you know, Wakanda isn't, you know, their version of Africa, or it isn't African, or it's really for the African-American gays, whatever. I think for me, regardless, like, this is the first time I will say that I've seen a movie with this kind of budget, this kind of production behind it, focused in Africa. And for me, even when they were like, oh, it's African, it's gonna be in Africa, I just thought it would be like some washed down version, but no, it was very as authentic as it could be. Like, I saw some Akan, I saw King Tate in there, I saw some Akan cloth worn the correct way. Like, it was beautiful to see. And David Oyelowo, who's a British Nigerian actor, was on like one of the night shows doing press rounds, and they asked him about Black Panther. He was saying that for him, I think he articulated what I think really well, because he was saying that for him, or for a lot of Africans, and this is how I feel as well, that we've always kind of known how dope our continent is and known how dope our countries are. And so even if technically with Wakanda, like, it took presenting a fictional place, right, for people to almost have to take a step back and start to see Africa in a new light, right? And Amala, I think you're going to get into that a bit more later in terms of just some of the tangible effects that we've already felt. But like, I completely agree, because we come from royalty, we come from such richness, be it with the culture, be it with the resources, be it with the whatever. But then obviously there's that disconnect in terms of, you know, the kind of narrative that's been spun for us. And so seeing this, yes, it might be fictional or whatever, but it was just such a beautiful reimagining of just, you know, our continent. And it's just like not something that we see often. And I think also, if you think about like the kind of complicated world we live in now in terms of colorism or whatever, like just seeing these complex, beautiful women, like it's just a lot. Anyway, enough fun girling from me.
Yeah,
Amala.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with you. It's interesting though, because I feel like I did read a lot of think pieces, but I don't think I read that much about people saying that, oh, Wakanda isn't like the Africa that they know, and that it was imagined for the African-American gaze or even the white gaze. Yeah. So could you elaborate on that one a little bit more? Because I actually am not aware of it.
Yeah, so I was listening to another podcast. I think it's called the AfroLit podcast, actually. And they had really good points. Like, they had, I want to say, they had people from across the diaspora. So I think they had some African-Americans, they had some Caribbeans, and then they had some Africans. I want to say they had some Southern Africans, and then they had some Western Africans. And, you know, for some of them, they felt to an extent that, yes, it's good, whatever, but they were like, well, Wakanda really isn't us, because for us, like, we know where we're from directly. So I think for them, sometimes it doesn't ring a bell, or it doesn't resonate like with the whole oh my gosh, like, I'm starting to see, like, I'm starting to become proud of my heritage, or I'm curious now to find out more about where I'm from, and that whole joke about we was kings and whatnot. like, it doesn't resonate with them, because they're like, I'm from,
I live this every day.
Yeah. I live this every day. Like, I know who I am. Like, this is how I was raised, like, blah, blah, blah. And so from that sense, it's like, excuse my language, like, no, four-letter word, Sherlock. Like, I know this already. And so for immediate members like of some African countries is very much. And I have a friend here in London who went to see it with his boys, and they were also saying the same thing, that it's a really good story, but it's not for them, because like they directly know where they're from and whatnot, and you know they're Nigerian or they're Ghanaian.
Okay.
They don't need like this fictional representation to have pride, because they already have in it their, in their immediate countries. Yeah,
they already have that.
Yeah.
Okay, that's an interesting perspective, and I guess I never thought about that, because I guess for me, the prideful part is like what could have been, you know what I mean? I've lived in Nigeria for the past year and a half as well, but like this clearly, like every corner you turn, there's clearly that effect of, you know, the British rule in Nigeria. Like you see where it is, like you see that in Abuja, you see it in Lagos, everything like that. And so for me, like what made me excited about Wakanda as an African front, like, you know, who was born in Africa or whatever, is the idea of like what could have been.
Yeah.
And then also just speaking to like, cause I know, I feel like it's, I don't know. Cause I think it's different. Everybody kind of has a different perspective, but I know for a fact that I met a lot of Nigerians that are not proud to be Nigerian, and they grew up in Nigeria. And so for them, they feel like, oh, there's nothing interesting here. Everybody's trying to move to the U.S., you know, or trying to move to London or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I think for people, I'm imagining for those people, it would have probably been great to see this, you know, African empire on a global stage, and everyone's celebrating it. Yeah. Then you're finally oh my gosh, like people like where I'm from, you know what I mean? Because some people who have never left Nigeria, they feel... Yeah. That and I know it's not everyone, they feel that there's nothing to be proud of Nigeria, they want to move out. But besides that, another interesting perspective that I've personally experienced, slash personally talked to people who have this perspective, is just what Black Panther has done for the African American community, but then also the Black diaspora at large, for people who are a little bit more removed from it, whether that means like you grew up away from Africa, or like you're a generation or two away, or like you're several generations away because of the slave trade or whatever. Mm-hmm. So recently I was part of the Black Love Experience, and I was doing the digital marketing. So I was part of the team behind the scenes, like working to bring this event to life. And so this is the fifth year that we've done it. And so this year, since we knew that Black Panther was going to be coming up around, we're like, okay, let's make some of the themes touch on some of the themes from Black Panther. So that's things like Afrofuturism, imagining like the Black, like the African future with like a little bit of sci-fi mixed in, a little fantasy mixed in, but then of course like a lot of those ancient cultures and traditions definitely at the forefront as well. Mm. So and then also like sealing all of that up with some like Black excellence, royalty, and things like that. So those were the themes that we were trying to go for Black Love, for the Black Love for the fifth year. But what we weren't expecting, because I mean, we knew everybody was hyped about Black Panther, but we just didn't realize like how hyped people were going to be. Like we just, you know, like nobody was expecting Black Panther to blow up at the level that it did.
I was.
Such an awesome reception. But you're the one that just said that, like, you went in with, like, oh, like, let me temper my expectations. No one expected it to, like, hit those box office records.
No, but I did, though. I did expect to hit those box office records. I think for me, my whole thing about let me temper my expectations was that sometimes, you know, when you build up something too much in your mind, then even if that thing is really good, like you set the bar here, and so it's going to be hard for that thing to meet it. So that's why I was like, okay, you know what, let me just give it a fair fighting chance. But in terms of its performance, like I knew it was going to do really well, because like I said, like I've had so many conversations with people where a lot of people are like, yes, I am excited for this movie. I'm waiting, because I feel like there is, and you know, even as I was thinking about this, I was like, okay, is a counterpoint perhaps that we're being like too Western identified or too Western focused and blah, blah, blah. Because like in Ghana, for instance, we have, you know, Gollywood. We have like the Ghanaian film industry. Nigeria has Nollywood. Like, you know, different African countries have our own like movie industry. So we're not waiting on Hollywood to tell our stories. Like we're telling our own stories like every day. Mm-hmm. But of course, you can't deny that a movie with this kind of budget and this kind of platform,
you, like, audience, yeah,
yes, can reach a global audience in a way that our movies haven't gotten to that perspective, like, haven't gotten to that growth level yet. And I think mm-hmm. that, you know, sometimes we downplay it a bit or whatever, but ultimately, you know, media shapes so much of how mm-hmm. We perceive different things, right? And so,
yeah, even ourselves.
Yeah.
Like, as much as we want to be like, oh, I'm above that, like, I, you know, I'm beyond, like, societal stereotypes, like, I can think beyond those, like, biases, blah, blah, blah. Like, no, like, I mean, like, to an extent, yeah, you probably can, but, like, there's going to be those, some deep-seated things that have been, like, told to you for generations and things like that. Yeah. And so I think that's why Black Panther was just, like, really, really important for people to be like, oh, wow, so, like, people can see my culture on the stage and be excited about it, you know what I mean? And then, like, even Black businesses that were represented at Black Love, because there were vendors there as well, at the Black Love Experience event, there were vendors there as well that were like, oh, yeah, like, Black Panther has done so much for my business, because now people are just really, really interested in, you know, African history, African cultures, mm-hmm. And so they want to know more. And, you know, of course, like, a lot of people, like, dressed up to go to Black Panther, and, like, you know, wear, like, the shikis and, like, you know, Ankara and everything like that. And so these people that sell these things already, like, they saw, like, a really high profit margin this time around, because now more people were, like, interested in those materials, wanted to know more, and things of that nature. So I think, like, the fact that Black Panther has been able to touch so many chords means that it's done a really, really good job, and I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. Like, I remember, like, when it came out, like, it broke box office records in Brazil. It started a couple of different movements there. I know, like, in South Africa, it broke records. Like, I think, you know, it all speaks to the hunger that we've all had to just see ourselves in a way that is a bit truer than the short end of the stick that we get. And Lupita also articulated this very well in one of the press interviews that she and Danai goddesses did. And Lupita was saying, for instance, that, you know, what colonialism did for the African continent was that it essentially rewrote our story, because she was highlighting the fact that Wakanda isn't completely fictional, right? It's drawing inferences from our culture and our history and empires that have been, some of which we're going to touch on a bit later in the podcast, but, you know, drawing inferences and drawing references and influence from that too, and then, you know, as she said, kind of pushing that into, like, a futuristic setting. But her point was very valid and articulated very well how I felt, because I remember, like, watching the movie and I was just like, oh my gosh, like, I am so floored at, like, what is in front of me. And then once I did come out, like, I got really sad. And, you know, whenever I talk about this, I'm like, okay, maybe I was just being, like, a bit too emotional. But for me, it was very much like, oh my goodness, like, what could have been? Like, what could my continent, what could my country have looked like right now, right this minute, right? If we had been left alone, if we had never been invaded by the Portuguese, then the British, then the Lord knows who, and gotten
looted. Yeah, and then the slave trade, and then...
Yeah, and all the craziness that have happened in our history, and, you know, given us two completely different starting points. So whereas some civilizations were able to get their starting point, yes, so have been able to sustain that starting point that started, you know, 8, 7, however many centuries ago. You have a country like Ghana where we recently celebrated our independence, and we literally just became our own country, being able to forge our own destiny, quote unquote, because if you examine that, we're not really, not necessarily, because we only won independence in 1957. Like, that is not that long ago at all. You come and then you're like, oh, Africa, developing countries, blah, blah, blah. But it's like, well, let's take a look at our history, shall we? Because it's not fair to then just suddenly thrust these kind of monikers on us, because we haven't been given that fair chance for us to flourish and for us to reach our peak for ourselves, like, by ourselves. And so for me, that is one thing that really, really, really resonated with me about Black Panther, mm-hmm. and made me think a lot more, because I also, I think, a lot of times I think about it and I'm like, maybe I just don't know my history enough, because, I started to travel a bit more now and, you know, visiting different places and kind of seeing some of the sites that are up for show. And I think about it and I'm like, Ghana, like, where do we fit into this equation? But it's always kind of confounded me because, well, not always kind of confounded me. This is a recent thing. But I was very much like, I am sure that we had something. We had to have. Because then when you come to Ghana, you're thinking about tourism, like, if you're looking at, like, architecture and whatnot, it's like the Elmina Castle. The Elmina Castle wasn't built by Ghanaians. It has, you know, as you probably know, it has a horrendous history because it was used for slave trading. And now this is one of the biggest tourist attractions, you know, in my country. And yeah, it's a lot of thoughts. Anyway, Amalai, I've been speaking loads. You can interject, because I know you also have some really interesting thoughts on this issue.
All right. So, yeah, that's a really, really good point about just, you know, what about our own self-direction and, like, our history for ourselves, by ourselves, things like that. Because I remember one time a friend of mine, at Elon, actually, you know, so a friend of mine asked me, why don't we see any inventions and great thinkers coming out of Africa? And so her point was kind of like, you know, things like, even simple things as, like, you know, paper came from China, you know, gunpowder came from China, things like that. So she wasn't saying that, like, oh, only thinkers come from the West or whatever. She was just saying, like, where are the technological innovations of Africa? And I just, and the way she asked it, it wasn't in an ignorant, like, yeah, oh, I don't know anything about Africa kind of thing. It was just, like, more of, like, a genuinely interested, like, where are all the great African thoughts and inventions? And so that kind of made me think, and I was like, dang, like, where are they? You know? And so, but, like, I was like, wait, no, like, I think there are. And so for me personally, like, this is kind of, the, you know, the process of being more woke, more aware of your own culture and everything. But it made me sit back, and I was thinking, like, okay, so, like, what are the main reasons why we're not seeing these great African thinkers, these great African inventions? But then also, like, I know that they're there. It's just a matter of, like, how they're presented, right? So on the one part, they are there. You just don't hear about them because we only learn about Western history, Western philosophy, Western inventions, things of that nature. And, like, yeah, world history class will teach us a few things about China, you know, teach us a few things about Japan or whatever, the Aztec Empire, things like that. But hardly do you see world history class talking about, you know, the Benin Empire, the Ghana Empire, things like that. And, like, if they do, it's, like, a very primitive, like, right before they met the British kind of history, like, not a, this is, like, their whole history, this is the technological advancements they had. It's not that. It's, like, just, this is what they were doing right before they met the British, or the French, or the Portuguese, or who, what have you. And so by the time Westerners hit Africa, we actually had a lot of really rich history. We had a lot going on, but it was, like, we just hear about the looting and the, well, we don't learn about it. We just, it was immediately looted. It was immediately pillaged. So, like, how can you say that we don't have any great Western, we don't have any great African thinkers or inventions when all of that was destroyed? You know what I mean? Like, the British, at least, I don't know that much about the French colonialists, but the British were very, very particular about ensuring that, like, you know, divide and conquer. And then, like, you conquer people, like, from the inside out. Right, you destroy everything they know about themselves. Like, that's kind of why, like, in that movie, The Roots, make him forget his name. Like, they, like, whip him into saying, "What's your name?" You know what I mean? So, like, if you think about that, but on the larger scale of, like, whipping an entire continent into, like, this is not who you are. Like, the British were very particular about making sure they erased our history so that we only knew theirs, and that's what we look to as, like, the pinnacle of intellectualism and advancement. And so, like, of course we don't hear about the great African thinkers and the great African inventions, which there were a lot of. So Wakanda just really made me reflect on, Black Panther and, you know, the imagining of Wakanda really made me reflect on that. Like, you know, what you were saying, like, what could have been, like, we don't even know the extent of what the British and the Portuguese and the French destroyed. Like, there's a lot about African history that we'll just never know. So on the one hand, like, yeah, a lot of it has been, a lot of our history has been erased, but there are still a lot of really great African thinkers and inventions that we can be proud of. It's just that we don't learn about them. You know what I mean? So there's things like, you know, like you were talking about with Ghana's independence, that came about because a lot of great African thinkers were talking across borders about Pan-Africanism and about, like, looking internally at African intellectualism and, like, how we can be, like, one great Pan-African, like, not nation in the sense of, like, political nation, but nation in the sense of, like, thinking and cultural and, like, working together to advance our nation. And then the French former colonies, now, you know, recent countries, also had a similar line of thought, which they called negritude. So that was just, like, you know, the idea of being black. I mean, the idea of being proud of the black skin and the black culture. So we do have these great thinkers. And so kind of my answer to my friend who asked me, like, where are the great African thinkers and inventions, is that, one, they're there. We just don't learn about them. And two, a lot of the really awesome stuff has been erased.
Yeah, I think for me, I think being a Ghanaian, Pan-Africanism is definitely something that we luckily got to learn about, because Kwame Nkrumah, who won independence for us, was one of the pioneers of the Pan-Africanism movement. He had studied abroad and, you know, returned to Ghana with a fire in his belly for us being able to move away from British colonial rule, and also wanting that vision to be achieved across Africa. So yeah, I completely agree with you in the sense that we had so many great thinkers. I know that, you know, some of his ideologies and whatnot shaped some of the Black Panther movement and some of the civil rights movement in the US. So kind of like the diaspora effect that that had. So we have lots of great ideologies stemming from the continent. Do we hear about it that much on a day-to-day basis? Not necessarily, because I think the Pan-Africanist vision hasn't been achieved. We have, to a certain extent, like, we have, like, the African Union, and we have ECOWAS, you know, trying to force that.
Right, okay. So I think we can see some of those great thinkers and, like, great history that we should hold on to a little bit when we look at African tourism. So a lot of times when we think about African tourism, we're thinking of places like Elmina Castle, Gorée, all these bastions of colonial legacy. And so, like, while yes, it's important to visit those places to ensure that we never repeat the past, never repeat the slave trade, but also understand it and understand what happened, those aren't the only attractions in Africa. But it sometimes it feels like they are, because our main tourist attractions are those. And most of the, like, world heritage sites around various African countries are, like, colonial legacies. Like, you know, Elmina Castle, like I've already said. But one other world heritage site that I know about, at least, is the Sacred Grove in Osun State, Nigeria. And so this place is, like, you know, a grove, like, that the Yorubas who moved into that area of Nigeria, like, that's where, like, their civilization kind of started and emanated from. But it didn't become a World Heritage Site until this Austrian woman came and was, like, really enamored by it, and she played a really huge part in, like, ensuring it became a World Heritage Site. So it just kind of makes me think about, like, the idea that how proud are we of our own culture, even though we have so much to present and so much to talk about. A lot of times it's either that we've forgotten about it, or we think that there isn't that much to be proud of, or people feel like it's not something interesting, or that it's not part of our authentic story. And so the reason why I'm using the quote-unquote authentic story is that I remember one time when I was in Ghana, I took an Elon trip there. I was with a student, I was with other students, other Elon students, and we traveled to different parts of Ghana. So we started in Accra, went east to Sokoto, went up to Kumasi, and then came back down to Accra. And then, so one student, like, while we were in Accra, they were like, oh, like, I hate that we're spending so much time in Accra. Like, we should spend the whole time in the village, because I feel like we're not experiencing the authentic Ghana. And I was like, like, what do you mean by that? Like, what do you mean by authentic Ghana? And he's like, oh, you know, like, the skyscrapers and the cars and stuff. Like, it's just, you know, it's not the village, like, this isn't authentic Ghana. And I was like, but isn't there real Ghanaians and authentic Ghanaians, like, living in those buildings, driving those cars? And so this idea that authentic, quote-unquote, and the only real Africa is, like, you know, the, quote-unquote, primitive Africa, like, those huts and the villages and things. And so this idea that underdeveloped and, quote, and then therefore Africa only has one image, and that's the image of the huts and, like, the women who only tie rafas and are, like, bare-breasted, soft, like, whatever. Things like, you know, little things like that. Like, for them, that's the only image of Africa. And even though there's, like, they're presented with skyscrapers and cars and things, they're like, oh, no, like, this is not part of Ghana. And so they wanted to see the real Ghana, whatever that might mean.
Whatever that might mean. Yeah, and I think, I think, you know, I completely agree with your point. Like, it's... It seems a lot of times it's like there is very much this strong preconceived notion about what Africa is and what Africa is supposed to be. And, you know, don't get us wrong. Like, we're completely proud of our huts and our bare-breasted women.
Yeah.
And no, absolutely. But this idea that that is the only, that is the only thing, and, you know, that's just it, and anything else is completely, like, doesn't gel with the African narrative. It's a bit silly.
Yeah.
And I think for me, this is something that I've had to personally explore, because I've been doing a lot of travels recently and getting confronted, you know, once again through tourism, like, by exploring different sites and thinking to myself, man, where is our stuff? And right. You know, thinking to Elmina House, I'm like, well, that's not really our stuff, so where's our stuff? Has kind of made me a bit curious and been having a lot more of these conversations with different people. And so Wakanda also, once again, played a really good role in that by bringing to the forefront this vision and this reimagination of Africa that really made me curious, because, you know, like we highlighted, they didn't pull this out of thin air. It came from, you know, past empires and past civilizations and just things that are present within the continent. And so one of the things that we're going to talk about in this next section of the podcast is about Benin City. So we thought, you know, we're both having these conversations about, whoa, like, what does this reimagination look for us? Like, how much do we know? Is there more we should know? So we thought, yeah, you know, why not?
And what does it look like to be developed? Like, kind of redefining the idea of development that, like, huts and bare-breasted women doesn't mean primitive. Like, it's just a different idea of development. Like, development doesn't have to look the same way.
Exactly. So we're going to highlight one city that we've done, you know, in our curiosity, just went and wanted to learn more about, because, you know, like we said, one of the visions and one of the aims of this podcast is to continuously, you know, we're enthusiasts, right? So we're learning about this as we're talking to you. So essentially we're learning and having conversations and broadcasting them. that should be the tagline of this podcast. So I have a friend who's Nigerian and who's Benin, and he had told me about Benin City, and I was like, huh, interesting. I have never heard of this. As once again can be a lot of the responses you have to our history, which is something we're going to come back to. But yeah, so he told me about the city, and I've been very curious ever since then. And so once again, you know, once this conversation started happening, I was like, okay, let me go back and just read a bit more. So just like some FYIs, like, the Benin Empire was one of the most advanced and one of the oldest ones in West Africa, dating back to the 11th century. And so their capital was Benin City, which was also known as Edo. And so that kind of empire is, you would place it as the southern part of Nigeria right now. And some of the things that I was reading, for instance, is going to get very facts-y here. So, we all know about the Great Wall of China, right? It's one of the biggest marvels now, and we take trips there to look at it. But it turns out that the walls of Benin City, you know, in their prime, actually dwarfed the Great Walls of China. So the official text here is that Benin City's walls were at one point in time 4 times longer than the Great Wall of China and consumed more material than the Great Pyramid of Cheops. And for me, like, I genuinely just had no idea whatsoever about anything like this even existing. Like, some of the highlights that, like, I put down from, like, my research was, one, like, the mathematical rigor that underlied how the city was planned. So, and this is me being a novice, I'm like, you can probably talk a bit more about it, but something called fractal design, which is very much like, you know, like with snowflakes. And I'm like, do you want to explain this part? Because
yeah, so fractal design is basically this natural occurrence of the way that things splinter off. And so if you think about things like snowflakes and lightning bolts, they have like one central point and they splinter off, and they're actually like splintering off into tinier and tinier versions of themselves. And so the exact same equation is going out, but like in tinier and tinier fractions. And so it's just really cool. So we see the snowflakes, we see it in those flowers that you blow on, we see it in a lightning bolt, and we just see it in a lot of different places in nature. And so it actually took a while for mathematicians to figure this out. So the fact that the Benin Empire like had it down and like had it planned into their city is like a big deal, because it's a really complicated mathematical equation, but it's also one that's very natural and occurs in nature. And so that just kind of goes into the idea of like how African nations were developed, but they developed alongside nature as opposed to like destroying it, you know. And I think for me, that's a much, that's a beautiful way to develop, like, and talk about development.
Exactly. And I think it very much challenges the idea of that, of the fact that like development should look one way. It should not, because, you know, in the things that I was researching, it was very much so that when the Europeans got to Benin City, they're like, oh my gosh, it's so primitive. And it wasn't until much later, just like Amalia had said, that they realized this is a more advanced form of math and planning that we hadn't even comprehended. And
but by then they had to destroy it too.
Oh my gosh, girl. this girl just,
sorry,
put,
Nancy over here.
She just literally put a major spoiler. Like, girl, can we just bask? Can we bask in the beauty before we get to that part?
Yeah, glory, yes.
Leave us be. Okay, so let me delve into a bit more of the highlights. So another was that, you know, it was one of the first cities with like a semblance of electricity. So one of the notes that were made in the accounts was the fact that like they had huge like street lamps almost that were powered by palm oil. So it lit the way to and fro the Oba's palace. I'm like, did I pronounce that correctly? Is it Oba for the king?
Oba Palace. Yeah.
Oba. Okay.
Oba, so Palace.
For the Oba's palace. And once again, lots of notes were made about just the development. So it was very much a wealthy city. It was very much a very complex society in the sense that people lived in peace and harmony. And there was a lot of trust, so much so that one of the accounts made note of the fact that people didn't even need to have locks on their doors because they were all right. Meanwhile, in London at the time, the comparison is made that it was, you know, a den of thievery and prostitution and etc. And so, I think for me,
that's another form of development to look at. Like, you know, like, yeah, we can look at technological advancement, but we can also look at, you know, moral development as well, like how advanced that is. And because I just feel like we should get past the idea that there's only one way that development looks like it doesn't all have to be technological or economic. It can also just be the way people interact with each other and intellectual development as well. Exactly. And it sounds to me like Benin City had it all going on. They had the technological advancements like on point to the past, like way past like English mathematicians at the time. You know, they had the infrastructure development going on, and they had a lot of moral maturity as well as a community. So exactly. For me, like, that is what, like, That's awesome.
And I think for me, another really good highlight that I took away from this, so I'm sure at some point you've been to some museum, and the irony of this does not escape me, and hopefully we have enough time to touch on this a bit more, but you've been to some museum somewhere in the Western world and seen those extremely complex and intricate Benin bronze mask or various bronze works.
Statues.
So that was, yes, that was also a trademark or a hallmark of that Asian Benin city. So a lot of cast bronze and carved ivory were used to make very complex art. A lot of times they were commissioned for the Oba. And one cool fact that I learned is the fact that they actually were used to serve as historical documents. So essentially a piece of art could be made in such a way that it would be a mnemonic to remember your history. And I never knew that. So
always they just presented as like, oh, like, look at this primitive art, like, so cute.
But that's not the case at all. And I think once again, it comes back to the idea of difference, right? Of the fact that, yes, like, in some ways, it has been a bit to our detriment of not being able to have, you know, written down our history. But I think the fact that it was actually still...
But it was recorded, it just wasn't written the way that Europeans said that, like, oh, this is the way history should be recorded. We had our own way of recording history, and because Europeans didn't understand that, they were like, oh, these people have no history.
Exactly. Yeah, that was exactly my point that I was getting to. The sense that it shouldn't be one size fits all. You've written yours down in one particular way. It doesn't mean that this other people or these other traditions have to have stored it in this same exact way. And so I thought that it was really cool that, you know, you had a kingdom, for instance, where art served such a beautiful purpose, and there was also like a lot of spirituality linked to these pieces. And of course, as with any other African country, you know, be it back then or now, they were extremely rich, extremely rich in natural resources. Some of the key products were palm oil, rubber, and ivory, and the Benin Empire really fought hard to be independent from colonialism up until the 19th century. However, we also have to know that their decline kind of started around the 15th century, and surprise, surprise, it was sparked by just loads of internal conflicts that were arising from increasing European intrusion and slave trade at the borders of the Benin Empire. So I think for us, what this highlights is, you know, I hope that this is something that you didn't know, because I definitely didn't know it until my friend told me about this and I did some more research about it. So I think it's really cool that there is this, you know, extremely complex, and this is just one of many cities, that we can point to. I think what's sad, for instance, is the fact that, like, you probably have never heard of Benin City, because there is not much left of it.
I think people have heard of Benin City, but we just remember it as, like, oh, the city where a lot of the British gold came from. I don't know. I feel like for me, before I knew more about Benin City, like, that was, like, my first touch point to it, you know, because I feel like I do remember us talking about Benin City, like, in world history class in high school, but, like, it was just very quickly, like, oh, this empire, and then the British came, slave trade started, and the empire was gone. Like, we didn't learn about all the palm oil lamps or, like, you know, the super complicated way that they structured their city and everything. So I don't think it's that people don't know of these African empires, but they don't know the extent of their technological and intellectual advancement.
I think for me, with Benin City in particular, I genuinely didn't know much about it. So for me, it is very much like, I knew of the empire because in history class in Ghana, we had touched on different empires and civilizations, but I mean, there's only so much time to delve into only so many of them. So Benin City was not one that I was familiar with. So I didn't even know about British gold, British whatever, none of that. So for me, this is a very interesting expedition to make. I think one of the next things that we're going to delve into that kind of also helps us kind of answer the question about or highlights the point that we make a lot of times that it's complicated. Like, we have a lot of rich history. It just it is a bit more complicated in its entirety is the Benin Expedition of 1897, because I don't think it's complete to talk about this amazing empire and what happened to it if we don't touch on this. So as I had mentioned, the Benin Empire had tried to resist colonialism for as long as they could, but eventually essentially they were sitting on a gold mine and they were in a very advantageous position in terms of trade. And so because they weren't willing to come to sign a treaty with the British that would give them access to, you know, these awesome materials that they needed, the British were continuously talking about, oh my gosh, you're so primitive and barbaric, they need our intervention on a humanitarian ground. That was a fail, where they came on a mission trying to depose the king, and they heard about it and massacred the British. And the British came back with bigger ships and bigger crew of men and burned the city to the ground. What is very interesting to note, so you have a whole, you have something so rich, so complex like this, that now we have very little remnants of in terms of this beautiful architecture and fractal planet that we've just talked about, completely destroyed because it was burnt to the ground and people had to flee. I think in some literature is known as the sacking of Benin. So a lot of what happened in the aftermath was that all the beautiful art that we've talked about, over 2,500 artifacts, were looted. A lot of them were just sold off in auctions to pay for the price of the expedition that they had taken to burn it down. And then, of course, now we have a section in the British Museum where you can find some Benin art if you want to appreciate it. And then someone also sold off to soldiers and whatnot, and auctioned off to different museums.
Sorry, that scene in Black Panther,
yes,
where Killmonger was like, oh, how did you think you got this? Like,
literally
so he was in London, like he was at a British museum, so like
he was at a British
super,
yeah. So that is just, you know, a couple of highlights from, you know, from this great industrious city. And I think for me, what you know, there are lots of different key takeaways, you know, that I can take from this. But I think for me, it just really has challenged me and has made me curious, I think, to just learn more about the greats, right? Because I think that, you know, we talk about a lot about, oh my goodness, like there's just this one narrative that we're being given. Okay, that's fine. How can we challenge ourselves some more to know our history and to know our worth and to know our stuff? And so I am hoping to go on more and more of that path, because I think, like I said before, like I had a lot of questions coming off the back of recent travels that I've taken. And so I think it's really cool that, one, that curiosity was piqued, but two, something like Black Panther pushed me to be like, you know what, let me go do some research. So I think moving forward, it's really important for us to know that we have a lot to be proud of. It's just a matter of, we need to seek that out more, because it's not going to be readily presented to us, right? Exactly. So if we're very much wanting to take control of our narratives and wanting to just be in charge, some of that is just gonna have to come from us. Like, if we don't want a version
of
that, Yeah, if we don't like the version of Africa that we're being served, let's, you know, take a step back and explore some more about some of the greats and the positives that are there. Amalia?
Right. And so, like, that can either be, like, as, you know, reading about it, reading books, fiction and nonfiction of, like, past African writers, current African writers, things of that nature, doing research on the internet. But it's also about, like, talking to people as well, like, meeting other people from different countries. Like, like I'm happy to have friends, you know, like, you from Ghana, from, like, Zimbabwe, from South Africa, things like that.
Because,
just knowing people. And then also, if you can, touring, like, going to African cities and seeing stuff for yourself, like, one of the things that I really enjoyed about living in Nigeria this past year and a half was just seeing different parts of Nigeria. Like, I went north, I went to a couple places in the east, and I explored the southeast a lot more than I've ever done before. So just being able to see various parts of, like, African cities as they are now, and then that way, as we move forward, we keep that, we keep the history in mind, we keep those intellectual conversations in mind, and then as we create this future that we want, we keep in mind that development does not all have to look the same way, and we recreate the future that we want to see.
Exactly. So yeah, I think, you know, we're probably going to wrap up at this point. I think all in all, it comes back to, you know, what started this conversation, you know, in the first place and what we framed it around, which is Black Panther. It's been extremely refreshing to see this representation and this reimagination of ourselves on screen, but also the fact that it isn't a complete reimagination, that, you know, this is, or these are parts of our history
that are real, that are very real.
Exactly, that are perhaps a bit unsung. And so that has just been a breath of fresh air. So yeah, Amalia, final thoughts?
I just love the way that Black Panther touched on a lot of really different topics and wasn't shying away from it. Like what we were saying earlier about the scene in the museum, and then like Shuri being like, don't scare me, colonizer. Like they just, the little ways that they touched on things, like on topics like colonialism, without shying away from it. But then also just like mostly just celebrating Blackness and Afrocentrism, if that's a word, and just putting it center stage and not being shy about it, or like not just putting like snippets of it, but like putting it like full and in living color. And I just love that. And I want us, like, even after we, I mean, not that the craze will ever die down, but even like a few months from now, when we're not talking about Black Panther every day, I want that spirit of like recreating our future and like being proud of our history and our culture. I want that to continue to take center stage in our lives and in our conversations, so that as, you know, our generation takes up the leadership roles in our various countries, either abroad or, you know, back at home, that we are creating the future that we want to see, and that we never get back to a point where we're like, oh, we never see ourselves represented on TV. Like, you know what I mean? Like that we are making those spaces for ourselves and driving the narrative that we want to hear.
Exactly. I can agree with you more on that point. So on that fabulously articulated point from Amalia, we think we're going to end the podcast right here.
Thank you all so much for listening. This was a really great conversation, and we just love having these conversations with you guys, but we don't want it to end here. So definitely drop comments, find us on our social media handles, and just like let us know what your thoughts were. Like, what did you think of Black Panther? Like, what did it mean for you? And how have you seen it changing the conversations that you've been having in your various circles?
Yeah. So talking to you on the next episode. Bye.